Hi, I'm Byron York from The Byron York Show. I'll be out this week, but I wanted to leave you with a listen to some of the most popular episodes we've had thus far. I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you don't forget to download and subscribe to my daily podcast. Hear me get right into the news of the day. You can do it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Hope you enjoy this one. Hello and welcome to another edition of the Byron York Show, the No Chit Chat Podcast. We have a very special program tonight. First of all, we're actually recording this live at the Kirby Center of Hillsdale College in Washington, D.C. And unlike most podcasts in which I just talk, we have a very, very special guest, Molly Hemingway, editor-in-chief of The Federalist and a Fox News, a very popular Fox News contributor. Molly, thank you for joining us.
It is great to be here with you.
So we're supposed to talk about politics. A president's job approval rating is the best single predictor of how a party is going to do in midterm elections. And in the last few days, we've seen Joe Biden break through down into the 30s, lower than any other president has actually been at this point in his presidency. Should say George W. Bush, for example, got a lot lower than that and into the 20s in 2007 when Iraq was just going disastrously. So it takes a lot to get that far down. But Biden's managed to get pretty far down. And what we've seen, as the president's job approval has been sinking, as Democrats know what that means, they've talked about varying life rafts that might be out there. Maybe a Supreme Court decision on Roe just so enrages the nation that they reelect Democrats. Or a gun legislation or gun debate energizes their voters. Or maybe the January 6th committee gets them so excited that they all go out and vote for their Democrat candidate. What do you think?
It's an interesting strategy that they're working on. Usually, some of these things actually would be helpful for them. In this case, in this current climate, you know, Democrats control the presidency, the Senate, the House. They are remarkably unified in their policy agenda. They have very little disagreement from any Democrats about what to do, whether it's the border, guns, war in Ukraine. You know, these things get voted on, and they pass overwhelmingly with usually the entire Democrat Party supporting it. And I think the part that they haven't quite figured it out is that their own policies are the cause of their low approval ratings. I think, you know, Joe Biden is not a particularly unlikable guy. It's not that people are unfavorable toward him and his personality. It's that they really hate the policies of the party. And so they might look for a rescue from these other issues, but I mean, many of these other issues won't play their way anyway. You might recall that Democrats tried in the off-year elections in Virginia to make them all about abortion because Texas had passed a very restrictive law protecting unborn human life. That was a main campaign strategy they employed, and it failed miserably. I mean, Republicans won statewide for the first time in a long time, and likewise with the January 6th commission, I do think it might have an effect on voters, but not the way they're intending. I think people look at that and say, we have all these actual problems caused by the people who are in charge, and here you are wasting time on a one-sided show trial, and I think it's going to anger people even more.
I think we have this kind of incredible shrinking presidency. One of the things that really struck me about Biden's reaction to the news that we got last week that inflation was 8.6% annualized basis in May, huge rises in energy costs, in price of new and used cars, of groceries, 12%. I mean, just unbelievable numbers. And the White House is arguing on the one hand that the president just can't do much about this. But I think, and the, you know, it's all Putin's price hike, I think they've gotten a little worried about this. I think, you know, Joe Biden was already in the Senate when Jimmy Carter was elected president. And I think these Carter comparisons are, first of all, they're apt. I mean, I think they're pretty much on. But I do think they're worrying this White House. Because Carter, if you've read about the Carter years, I believe more than half the country was born after 1980. So they've had to read about the Carter years. The other people remembered it. But there was this idea of a shrinking presidency and an ungovernable nation, that the problems were just so severe that they couldn't be governed. And Ronald Reagan just changed that when you had a competent president who was elected. But in the Carter years, that was this sense. And I think you're beginning to get the same thing with Biden, which is one of the reasons he came out this very day and wrote this letter to the CEOs of the oil companies, you know, demanding that they explain their refinery costs and all that. But he's getting more and more Carter-esque by the day. Although I should say, Jimmy Carter was elected at age 52. He was sharp, and he was on things. He was a terrible president, but he was alert, more so than a president today.
Yeah, I think sometimes the comparisons are unfair, but unfair to Carter. redeeming qualities. So much of what has been done to cause inflation was caused by these policies. I mean, yeah. There it's always a monetary phenomenon. The best thing that happened to the Democrats was when Joe Manchin killed their Build Back Better, because it would be even worse if we had pumped even more money into the system. The inability to take responsibility for what's happening, even in the arguments about Putin causing all of these things, Putin did unfairly, unjustly invade Ukraine, but to not understand that the U.S. response has follow-on effects on our economy, and that this was not the best time to wage a sanction war or spend the massive amounts of money that we're spending in Ukraine, given what the situation is. It just seems that, like that op-ed that Biden wrote, where he said he had a three-pronged plan for what to do with inflation.
About inflation, yes.
And the first one was, let the Fed do whatever it wants. And the second part was like, begin to look into supply chain problems. Yeah. And the third was like, basically think about raising taxes.
Yes.
I mean, none of these things are adult responses, but until the Democrats actually take responsibility for how their policies have brought the country to where they are, and it's not just inflation,
right.
It's general economic malaise and, you know, foreign policy problems, border problems, crime that is rampant, civil unrest. It just feels like the country is falling apart. And Biden's whole claim was that he would be a unifying, moderate president, and competent. Remember? This is like a return of competency. None of these things are happening. He's blaming everyone but himself.
First thing on his list was not to be mean to the Fed, because he said that the previous president had demeaned the Fed and that he wouldn't do that. So in his list. Now, I think if you listen to Democrats, and if you read liberal journals, there's almost a admission, a consensus now, that the first of these so-called COVID relief bills, the American Rescue Plan, $1.9 trillion, was too big. It was bigger than needed to be. Of course, everybody knew that at the time, but they had all this pent-up Democratic demand, and they just wanted to spend as much as they could. The extraordinary thing, it seems to me, for Republicans who are running now, inflation being the top issue on everybody's mind, is that not only is there a general agreement that President Biden and the Democrats made it worse, but if they had had their way, they would have made it much worse. There was this huge debate about Build Back Better. Would it be $3.5 trillion? Would it be just $2.5 trillion? Would the progressives have their way and it be $6 trillion? I mean, the disastrous effects that would have ensued had they had their way. And really, Joe Manchin is kind of plays a heroic role in stopping this.
The unlikely Democrat hero. I mean, because the Democrats were mad at him, but he saved them.
He saved them from themselves. I mean, it would be way worse today. And again, their so-called moderate commentators are all admitting this now, that everything they did was wrong.
Are they really admitting it? I mean, they do admit it, but it is astounding to me that you can see this level of either intentional or unintentional incompetence. sorry, that reminded me about the energy issue. You were saying that Biden said he sent this letter to oil companies trying to figure out who committed the crime of high energy prices.
Right.
And I mean, it was not that long ago that he campaigned on a pledge to shut down fossil fuels.
Yeah.
And then immediately in taking action in office to shut down energy independence and intentionally lead to some of the situations.
He's absolutely trapped by his environmental climate change activist support. I mean, he can't come out and say, I mean, the basic problem is he has committed to their desire to reduce the amount of oil and gas in the American economy. The problem is we need more oil and gas right now. And he can't admit what's going on. And it's
wait, can we also talk about how he's making this trip to Saudi Arabia?
Delicious, isn't it?
But, you know, to beg for help with this.
And for them to produce more oil.
He was so adamant that he would never do this and that working with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was, like, beyond the pale when the previous administration did it. Every administration does it. There's an argument against it. But it seemed that people were really upset that the previous administration was just really honest about it, that the costs, the costs were too high in terms of not dealing with them. And to go back on his word after all of this and to not even mention, you know, in the public declarations of this, anything about human rights abuses, which he said would dominate any discussion. It's just interesting.
Yeah, I read some Saudi who said the other day, they always say they're going to stay away from us until they get their first security briefing. And then things change. All right. Now, we just had a new round of primaries. And I don't know how you view what just happened, say, in South Carolina, in terms of Trump's influence or non-influence. And you had a couple of members of Congress, Republicans, Tom Rice and Nancy Mace, who were running. And Rice voted to impeach Trump and really dumped on him in the campaign, just dumped on him all the time. And Nancy Mace tried to say that she supported Trump and just not on everything. And she survived, and he didn't. Any lessons in that?
Well, they were running in two very different districts, but I think Nancy Mace, you know, did not vote for impeachment. And she didn't just suggest that she was supportive of Trump. I think one of her ads had her in front of
Trump
Tower.
She went to New York, yes.
And so she was, you know, she probably should have had an easier time than she did. I mean, she won handily, or what was the final?
Yes.
She won fine. She probably could have done better if she had been, you know, an even stronger candidate. But I think what's interesting about the Rice thing is not just that he voted for impeachment. He also quite recently said he thought that Liz Cheney should be the Speaker of the House. I mean, there's disliking Trump, and then there's just being kind of crazed about
kind of
it.
A minority position. There.
And so that it seemed like he didn't actually want to win. But I think people in general make a problem of Trump's endorsements are important, and I think, you know, J.D. Vance would not be the nominee without Trump's endorsement. Mm-hmm. Mehmet Oz definitely would not be the nominee without Trump's endorsement. They definitely can be extremely important. Trump, in my mind, if he wanted to have more of a role in endorsements, would be not just to endorse, but to actually put some money and campaigning behind some of these endorsements.
Right.
I think his pick over Nancy Mace could have won easily if he had put a little bit more into it. So he doesn't do a perfect job with it, but he's clearly an important force, but not so much. Partly it's because of him. He's a very, essentially the leader of the Republican Party for the people. But because the people themselves are ready for a major change in how the Republican Party operates. Mm-hmm. They saw in Trump policy positions that they very much liked, and they saw an attitude of refusing to accept, like, second-class citizenship, which so many Republicans do. And so that continues to be extremely important, and I think after people win some of these elections in November, you'll see that change more in D.C., because we've yet to see people come in mass who have that different approach.
Now, there are a lot of Republican candidates who are quietly or not so quietly running for president. Do you think they would all stay in the race if Donald Trump entered the race?
No, I think some of them will, but I think if Donald Trump enters the race, and he's likely to, he'll, you know, I think people are kind of recognizing he'll likely be the nominee. And so that changes, you know, or almost certainly will be the nominee if he chooses to run, and he's probably choosing to run. So that definitely affects everybody's calculation on whether to go through it or what you're hoping to achieve.
So in other words, do only the Chris Christie stay in, or does anybody, does Mike Pompeo stay in, does Tom Cotton stay in? What does Ron DeSantis do? What do they do if Donald Trump runs?
I'm sorry, I really think it just depends on, you know, there will probably be people running in different lanes. I think the hot and heavy lane will be the people going for that 5% of the not Trump, you know, diehards. Mm-hmm. And so I bet you'll see that lane packed with people who are really trying to outdo each other.
Right.
And they will get massive media attention, and they will be well funded by by certain, you know, establishment figures. But as for the rest, I just don't know. I mean, I assume that you will see a lot of these people run, and until we get a feeling for what the reaction is, we don't know how far they'll go.
Yeah.
I actually think a heated primary is good for everybody, most especially including Donald Trump, who seems to thrive on defeating his opponents.
Yeah.
So one of the big mistakes, I actually think I wrote about it in my most recent book. I'm not sure if it was a mistake, but the campaign knew that every time an incumbent has a primary challenge, it hurts them in the general. So just think of George H.W. Bush and the Pat Buchanan thing. And so they worked very hard to make sure there would be no primary challenge. And it makes sense, and they did a really good job with it. But I actually wonder if defeating an internal opponent might have helped Trump more in 2020. And it would, you know, he does well when he's fighting against them.
Yes, I remember in Iowa in 2020, there was a big Trump appearance. And I went to an event with Joe Walsh, who was Trump's primary opponent, he and William Weld, and it was so sad. It was just, it was absolutely pathetic. So there was absolutely no competition. Seems to me that I agree with you, it would be a good thing to have a robust, multi-candidate primary, don't you think?
I thought 2016 was, or the 2015-2016 thing. Because a robust primary is also the means by which people can hash things out. It was fascinating to me to actually have foreign policy debates on those debate stages in 2016, which, you know, the Republican Party had desperately needed for like 20 years, and finally they happened through this debate stage.
Mm-hmm. But Trump, on the other hand, wants to be seen essentially as an incumbent president inside the Republican Party.
I don't know. I think that he understands there's still an establishment that opposes him, and so a lot of people like him because he opposes the establishment.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that I think is funny is so many people in Washington, D.C. would love nothing more than to get rid of Donald Trump. Obviously, that's what the J6 Commission is about and everything else. But, I mean, even in the Republican Party. And the way that they could have done that would be to adopt his principles and adopt his posture and thereby make him less powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, they managed to not do either of those things, reminding people why they hate the Republican establishment and thereby empowering him even more.
Well, but don't you think somebody like Ron DeSantis would say that, you know, the Republican Party has completely changed from the Bush years? It's completely different. It changed because of Donald Trump, and there's no going back.
Ron DeSantis has learned every lesson that should have been learned from the previous 6 years. It is just shocking to me that more people haven't learned those lessons.
Right.
It's not that there aren't a few other people who are learning those, but this idea of actually wielding power to advance conservative aims is, you know, it's like once you see it happen, you're like, oh yeah, we have been voting for people who haven't actually used the power that has been given to them. Or understanding that you can not just be reactive to assaults from the left in terms of attacks on founding or you know, basic principles, but you can actually fight back against those things. People, when they see them, they like them a lot and they want more of them.
Mm-hmm. All right, now we need to talk about what's happening here. We've had two hearings so far, the January 6th committee, and we're going to talk about that with Molly Hemingway next.
The Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski. Every day, Chris helps unpack the connection between politics and the economy and how it affects your wallet.
Are you at risk of losing your job to AI? Although some jobs will be eliminated, more jobs could be created. As the fears of artificial intelligence grow, will creative destruction work in this decade? What should you do to prepare?
Whether it's happening in D.C. or down on Wall Street, it's affecting you financially. Be informed. Check out the Watchdog on Wall Street podcast with Chris Markowski on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, I said I was going to talk with Molly about the January 6th committee. First, I do want to say, if you're listening to the podcast, enjoying the podcast, maybe even learning something from the podcast, it'd be really great if you could subscribe to the podcast. Please, you can do it iTunes, anywhere you get your podcast, would really appreciate it. So, Molly, we had the January 6th committee meeting amid enormous hoopla, beginning with a primetime session. And so, where do you think this is going?
So I've been kind of curious about, I understand why the committee started. Nancy Pelosi understands that she had a very difficult situation in terms of keeping the majority in 2022. And the only time in recent history where the party that controls the presidency has not lost, you know, significant votes in the first midterm is after 9/11. And so she has this idea that's totally reasonable, that if she can turn January 6th into 9/11, she might be able to keep a hold on her majority. So everything after that, though, has not made a lot of sense to me. So she, to have any legitimacy, the committee would, of course, have to have Republicans and Democrats. She appointed her favorite person, Liz Cheney, to be co-chair before Republicans appointed anyone. So that's a Democrat appointee. Republicans pick very reasonable people like Jim Banks from Indiana, Jim Jordan, who chairs that, or who's the ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee, and a few other people. And Nancy Pelosi kicks Jim Jordan and Jim Banks off. That's ridiculous. It just all of a sudden makes the committee completely illegitimate.
It was actually unprecedented, too. And Pelosi said it was unprecedented.
And also, it didn't make sense. Her argument was that because Banks and Jordan had problems with the 2020 election, that therefore they couldn't be on the committee. But of course, the chair of the committee had objected to a previous election in 2005, and they have a person on the committee who objected after the 2016 election in 2017. They have Schiff, who made up a grand conspiracy, or who like participated in a grand conspiracy theory that Trump stole the 2016 election. He lied and claimed he had evidence of it. I mean, the idea that they could be on the committee and people who had problems with 2020 could not made no sense. And so now they're having what they call hearings, but they've gone through a whole process where there have been no ranking members or minority rights.
Right.
So they haven't had a balance of information. They haven't had protection for the witnesses. They haven't, I mean, it's just a completely illegitimate, fraudulent exercise. And so I'm actually kind of appalled that people are going along with it and treating it like it actually is a legitimate committee with a legitimate hearing. As far as what their goal is, I assume their goal is to try to put Donald Trump in prison because they think that he, or you know, something really extreme like that, because they are thinking it's what they have to do to keep him from running again or winning again.
Right. Yeah, I think the number one goal is to, or the most immediate goal, is to try to associate Republicans with insurrection and maybe get a little, you know, ding a few in the midterm elections. And the other one is to somehow disqualify Trump from running again. I think it's pretty clear what they're going to do. On the other hand, I mean, January 6th was a big thing. What would have, and I think it cried out for investigation. What do you think a proper investigation of January 6th would look like?
So it's, I agree it's an important event. I don't agree that it's as important as the media and other Democrats have been making it out to be. But I think that a proper investigation actually can't even take place without understanding the context in which the event took place. So the fact that we had a four-year-long election conspiracy theory claiming that Donald Trump stole an election by colluding with Russia. We had that go on for years and years and years. It took over all, you know, branches of government. It affected foreign policy. It was a horrific hoax perpetrated against the American people. Pretty much, you know, a significant percentage of Washington, D.C. took part in this hoax. And none of them are in prison. None of them are in jail. None of them have been held accountable. And without that, you can't even begin to talk about a riot on January 6th. And even on a more, you know, on a smaller scale, we had a summer of coordinated, widespread riots where there were attacks on the White House, there were attacks on federal courthouses, police precincts, businesses and homes, and the American people were terrorized and terrified by it. Those were not condemned. They were supported by many of the same people who are now claiming to care about political violence. And again, until you hold people accountable, that's like up to and including Kamala Harris and Joe Biden for supporting that coordinated political violence, you can't begin to talk about January 6th. And then finally, until you understand the context of this was the weirdest election we had in our lifetimes. We had massive meddling from big tech and media companies. We had changes to hundreds of laws and processes right leading up to the election. We had one of the world's wealthiest and most powerful men overtaking election systems with private funding to run Democrat get-out-the-vote operations. You know, all of this is part of this January 6th conversation, and they want to jump right to January 6th, ignoring everything that led up to it, and it's just obscene.
So, how would you actually investigate that in a congressional sense?
So, as far as, I mean, I don't, I guess I find the whole thing, like, nobody actually thinks that this committee is trying to look into it. So they think they're, I mean, anyone reasonable just says they are trying to criminalize political dissent and cover up or, you know, avoid accountability for all of these things. Mm-hmm. As far as the riot itself, I actually don't even, I mean, I think from a congressional perspective, they definitely need to look into what the security lapses were. It is weird. I don't know if you covered it. I covered it with a few reporters. It was weird. I have covered tons of protests. Mm-hmm. Some have broken out into riots. I have never seen anything like this in terms of just the complete lack of police presence. Mm-hmm. I do think that's worthy of investigation. As far as, digging into how Republicans raised money to challenge election results, that doesn't seem very legitimate to me. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that, first of all, on the challenging election results, you can certainly argue that it was unwise to the degree that Republicans did it. But the chairman of the January 6th committee, Benny Thompson, in January 6, 2005, voted against certifying the results of the presidential election in Ohio, which would have changed the result of the John Kerry, George W. Bush race. He's later said that he wasn't really serious about that. But the fact is, they raised the same objection in the same way under the Electoral Count Act that Republicans did in 2020. And you know, objected to the certification. On January 6th, 2017, I actually made this a scene in my book, which was written before January 6th, which was January 6th, 2017, the Congress meets to certify Trump's victory in the Electoral College. And it's a ceremonial day. It's not supposed to be anything, really. And a number of them had been to the January 6, 2009 event where they certified Obama's victory, and they were all kind of swept away by how historic it all was. So they kind of viewed it as a nice day. And then all of a sudden these Democrats are just loaded for bear, and they began protesting and objecting to the certification of the results from several states. One of them is Jamie Raskin, who is now on the January 6th committee. And it didn't work. They didn't get a senator to go along with them. And by the way, presiding over it was Vice President Joe Biden. Biden and Paul Ryan were standing right next to each other. But the Republicans had seen how this was done. And, of course, then there had also been Democrats who were calling in the transition period between the 2016 election and Trump's taking office for electors to abandon Trump, to be faithless electors. Two or three of them did, I think. But they were hoping that if you could get enough, then Trump wouldn't be president.
They also released a dossier with the hopes of perhaps thwarting the inauguration.
Right. John McCain's close ally, David Kramer, was still hoping in the week before the inauguration to somehow stop it. So all this stuff was going on. And Republicans kind of learned from this. And I have to say they overdid it in the period of late December, early January 2021. And then you had the Capitol riot. So you needed some sort of investigation of this. But in terms of the actual objection that members of Congress raised, they were acting in a way consistent with what their Democratic colleagues had done in earlier years.
So Congress performs oversight, doesn't do like DOJ-style investigations. So I think the question is there something the Department of Justice didn't do well? I mean, it seems like they are willing to imprison every grandmother within a mile of the Capitol.
Yes,
so are they not doing enough there?
Yeah.
Or Congress was not the body by which you... I'm kind of a absolutist on Congress. They can do what they want, but this is not a normal function of them to do a one-sided...
It's absolutely not a normal function. And you're right about the degree to which Pelosi tried to equate January 6th and September 11th. I mean, this was a very open thing because they wanted to have a commission, just like there was a September 11th commission. So they wanted to have a commission, and the whole idea was that there was some sort of equivalence, which was absolutely obscene to suggest that there was an equivalence between... January 6th and September 11th, and it was 3,000 Americans were killed. The World Trade Center was destroyed. The Pentagon was attacked. And just to give you some idea of perspective, Congress met later in the evening of January 6th to certify Joe Biden's election. Imagine if a pre-planned convention event had gone on in the World Trade Center that night, because it was still there.
So
it's an obscene comparison.
I also, though, even though I tend not to agree with a lot of the objections that electors have put forth in recent years, Congress is an appropriate venue to air your complaints about the administration of elections. Like, you referenced what happened in 2005. Mm-hmm. That was about the Democrats' belief that voting machines in Ohio been hacked in order to deliver that victory.
They believe that Karl Rove had personally attacked.
Karl Rove had personally hacked.
Yes.
And, you know, they have been holding hearings in the Senate every year since then on the vulnerabilities of electronic voting.
Right.
I actually don't have a huge problem. It's not that I disagree that there are vulnerabilities in machines. I just think there are also vulnerabilities in human counting, and that to some extent it's it can even be safer in machines. But it's okay to complain about the administration of elections in Congress on January 6th or whatever the day is. That's an okay thing to do. It is, Congress is for the airing of these kinds of problems. It is, you can look back like 150 years and see that people have made complaints about the administration of elections at that time. And to criminalize that and make it out like it's something you can't participate in, or, you know, particularly for an election that really was sloppier and unlike any election we'd had. Yep. There was a coordinated campaign to weaken election security. Where are people supposed to claim? You know, it was so bad that people didn't even know what they were complaining about, which is why the legal effort was so bad, frankly, you know, in the aftermath of the election. Everyone kind of sensed there were problems, but it took, you know, a year or more to kind of figure out what some of those problems were. But the idea that you're not allowed to complain about things that you are witnessing, irregularities, whether you're Democrat or Republican, that's very un-American, I think.
All right. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much. So that wraps it up for this edition of the Byron York Show. Thanks for joining us. And hope you can join us again soon for another edition of the Byron York Show.